Hello, once again, this is Dr. Phil Fernandez, the founder of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the academic dean of Fariston Theological Seminary. Today's lecture is Apologetics Lecture Number 3. Apologetics Lecture Number 3. Today's discussion will be Creation Science. Creation Science Apologetics Lecture Number 3. Before we discuss creation science, we must first look at a brief history of the evolution-creation debate. A brief history of the evolution-creation debate. The creation model, and we'll explain what model is a little bit later in the study, the creation model dominated modern science before 1860. The creation model dominated modern science before 1860. You see, modern science was started by men who believed in God's existence. It's a very important point. Modern science was started by men who believed in God's existence. Men like Galileo, Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Johannes Kepler. Modern science was started by men who believed in God's existence. Men like Galileo, Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, and Johannes Kepler, and because of that, the creation model dominated modern science before 1860. You see, their belief in God's existence formed the basis for modern science. Let me repeat that. Their belief in God's existence formed the basis for modern science. You see, they believed that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way, so that through reason, man can find out about the universe in which we live. Let me repeat that. They believed that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way, so that through reason, man can find out about the universe in which we live. Now, what has happened is that evolutionists have thrown out this base for modern science. They've thrown out the reasonable God. Now, if evolutionists have thrown out this base for modern science, if they've thrown out the reasonable God of the universe, the question comes up, without a reasonable God, can the universe really make sense? Without a reasonable God, can the universe really make sense? We expect watches to work because they were made by a reasonable person. We expect the universe to make sense because we assume it was created by a reasonable God. But without a reasonable God, can the universe really make sense? How can there be any cause and effect relationship if there is no reasonable God? So the creation model dominated modern science before 1860. Now the evolution model dominated modern science after 1860. The evolution model dominated modern science after 1860. That was because in 1860, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species. In 1860, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species. He proposed a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe, first life, and new life forms. He proposed a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe, first life, and new life forms. He taught that nature can be explained without appealing to a supernatural origin. Charles Darwin proposed a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe, first life, and new life forms. He taught that nature can be explained without appealing to a supernatural origin. And this view became the dominant view in science since 1860. So a brief history of the evolution-creation debate. The creation model dominated modern science before 1860. Modern science was founded by men who believed in the existence of God. They believed that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way so that through reason man could find out about the universe in which we live. But after 1860, the evolution model began to dominate modern science. After Charles Darwin's classic work, The Origin of Species. Now that we've looked at a brief history of the creation-evolution debate, we need to understand what exactly the scientific method is. The scientific method. I want you to list these things down. What you're going to find is that the scientific method cannot prove a scientific fact. Scientific method cannot prove a scientific fact. Now let's look at six basic steps to the scientific method. The first step is observation. Observation. Second, there is the proposal of a question or problem. After observation, there is the proposal of a question or problem. Third, there is the hypothesis. The hypothesis, which is an educated guess. The hypothesis, which is an educated guess. Fourth, there is experimentation. Experimentation. Scientific experimentation. Fifth, there is a theory. The next step is a theory, which is basically, and this is important, a theory is a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. A theory is a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. And if that theory is shown to be valid on a universal scale, we have six natural law. We have a natural law. Natural law, a theory shown to be valid on a universal scale. Natural law is about as close to a scientific fact as you can get, yet it is still not a scientific fact. It's only a theory shown to be valid on a universal scale. So let's look at that again. The scientific method, one, observation, two, proposal of a question or problem, three, hypothesis, which is an educated guess, four, experimentation, five, theory, which is a hypothesis with a high degree of probability, and six, natural law, a theory shown to be valid on a universal scale. Now let's briefly discuss evolution and creation as they deal with the scientific method. How the scientific method applies to evolution, how the scientific method applies to creation. First, evolution. Number one, since the scientific method does not prove a scientific fact, the most that it can prove is a natural law, we need to recognize evolution is, number one, not a proven fact. Though many people believe evolution is a proven fact, even Charles Darwin, by the way, we're not talking about evolution and gradual change within a species. We're talking about evolution, gradual change from one species to another. Number one, it is not a proven fact. Even C.S. Lewis, the Christian defender of the faith, considered evolution a biological fact. It is not. Number one, evolution is not a proven fact. Number two, evolution is not a scientific law. So it doesn't even reach the realm of natural law, like the first or second law of thermodynamics, or the law of biogenesis, or the law of gravity. It does not even qualify to be a natural law. So it's not a proven fact, it's not a scientific law. And number three, it's not even a scientific theory. To call evolution a scientific theory is to misuse scientific terms. Evolution is not a proven fact, it's not a scientific law, it's not even a scientific theory. Why not? And this is important. Because evolution, the supposed evolutionary changes from one species to another, is not repeatable. It is not repeatable. Therefore, it is not open to observation and testing. Let me repeat that. Evolution is not a scientific theory. because the supposed evolutionary changes of the past are non-repeatable, and therefore they are not open to observation and testing. Now, if they're non-repeatable, if evolution is non-repeatable and not open to observation and testing, what does that say about the scientific method? Look at the first step in the scientific method. It's observation. You can't even start the scientific method. You can't even start evolution with the scientific method. The scientific method does not get off the ground. It does not even get started because evolution is not a scientific theory. It's not open. It's non-repeatable. It's not open to observation and testing. Well, then what is evolution? Evolution is only a scientific model. Evolution is only a scientific model. It's not a fact. It's not a proven fact. It's not a scientific law. It's not a scientific theory. But it is only a scientific model. What do we mean by model? A scientific model is a way to interpret the evidence. A scientific model is a way to interpret the evidence. Now, what about creation? We talked about evolution, that it's not a proven fact. It's not a scientific law. It's not even a scientific theory. It's only a scientific model, a way to interpret the evidence. In other words, you can't even start the scientific method, but it can be a scientific model, a way to interpret the evidence. And we're going to discuss how to test, how to compare models and decide which model is superior to the other. And that's different from the scientific method. It falls under what is called forensic science, crime scene investigation, science that falls into that category. But what about creation? Creation, number one, is in the same category as evolution. Creation is in the same category as evolution, which means, scientifically speaking, it's not a proven fact. It's not a scientific law. It's not a scientific theory. It is only a scientific model. So creation is in the same category as evolution. It is only a scientific model. And now we're going to try to discuss how we know which model is more plausible. But first we need to learn a little bit of something about forensic science, which is crime scene investigation. Those detectives who investigate crime scenes, they do not use the scientific method, yet it is considered science. Crime scene investigation is done. Number one, it is not operation science. It is not operation science. Why? Because operation science is something that is presently operating. In other words, it's got to be something that's repeatable. It's the science of the present. Science of the present, it's something that's repeatable. And since the murderer isn't going to murder his victim all over again, and again, and again, and again, it's not operation science. Instead, forensic science falls under the category of origin science. It's not operation science, not something that's presently in operation today, but it's origin science. It's non-repeatable, very important, it's non-repeatable. It's the science of the past, non-repeatable, science of the past, singular events that are no longer occurring over and over and over again. So forensic science, crime scene investigation, is not operation science, which is the science of the repeatable, science of the present. Instead, it's origin science, non-repeatable, science of the past, singular events. You see, you have no direct observation possible. No direct observation is possible. You can't go back to the crime scene and see the murderer kill the victim all over again. No direct observation is possible. You're dealing with singular, non-repeatable events of the past. You're dealing with singular, non-repeatable events of the past. Now, why are we talking about forensic science, crime scene investigation? The reason we're talking about it is because the supposed evolutionary changes of the past, the supposed evolutionary changes of the past are non-repeatable. supposed evolutionary changes of the past are non-repeatable. Also, the supposed special creation by God is non-repeatable. The supposed special creation by God is also non-repeatable. So we cannot use the scientific method, which goes with operation science, since it's repeatable and it can be observed, but we must go with different principles in order to test models under origin science. Well, what principles can we use? The two principles used instead of the scientific method for forensic science and for any type of origin science is, number one, the principle of uniformity. The principle of uniformity or analogy. This is of vital importance. The principle of, still under forensic science, the principle of uniformity or analogy. And this states, the principle of uniformity or analogy states this. We posit the same kind of causes that we see making certain effects in the present. Principle of uniformity or analogy states, we posit the same kind of causes that we see making certain effects in the present for similar effects in the past. I repeat that. The principle of uniformity or analogy, we posit the same kind of causes that we see making certain effects in the present for similar effects in the past. In other words, if we find a broken arrowhead that dates back 3,000 years, and if we see that it served a purpose and that it appears to be a design, therefore we assume that since designs take intelligent designers today, that that arrowhead needed an intelligent designer to make it before. So the principle of uniformity or analogy says we posit the same kind of causes that we see making certain effects in the present for similar effects in the past. And then secondly, the principle of causality. The principle of causality, which simply states every event has an adequate cause. Every event has an adequate cause, the principle of causality. So these two principles are used instead of the scientific method to test scientific models, which are different ways to interpret the evidence, and so we need to see which is more plausible. So which model, evolution or creation, is more plausible? You see, both deal with the same evidence. I'll give you an example. Common anatomy. The arm of a man, the arm of a gorilla, the wing of a bird, and the fin of a shark are all very similar. Common anatomy. Both models, evolution and creation, deal with the same evidence, common anatomy, yet they both interpret the evidence differently. The evolution model says, well, they're similar body parts, common anatomy, that means common ancestry. They're all related, they're all in the same family. So evolution says common anatomy teaches common ancestry, but the creation model says common anatomy teaches common design. Very important. The evolution model says common anatomy teaches common ancestry. The creation model says common anatomy teaches common design. So using the two principles we mentioned, the principle of uniformity or analogy and the principle of causality, we're now going to look and see which model is more plausible. Which model is more plausible? The first thing we need to look at when testing our models is the origin of the universe. The origin of the universe. The first point under the origin of the universe I'd like to make is energy deterioration is the second law of thermodynamics. Remember, a law is as close as you can come to a scientific fact through the process called the scientific method. So a law such as the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, it has much more scientific evidence backing it than something than a model like evolution. So in whatever way the laws, the scientific laws point, whatever model they point to, that's going to give us a good idea of which model is superior. So which model is more plausible? In the origin of the universe, energy of deterioration, the second law of thermodynamics teaches us that the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. I repeat, the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. You see, the universe is winding down. And if it's winding down, that means it had to be wound up. The universe is going to run out of energy, so that means the universe is going to end. But if it's going to end, that means it had to have a beginning. Now, the expansion of the universe also confirms this. As we go forward into the future, the universe, the elements of the universe expand, which means if we go back in the past, the elements of the universe get closer and closer together, which tells us, which gives scientists their view of the Big Bang model, that the universe started as one big explosion, and that the elements are getting further and further apart, so that if you go back in time, eventually you reach a point of infinite density where basically the universe was created out of nothing. So energy deterioration teaches us the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down, the universe is winding down, therefore, so it had to be wound up. It's going to have an end, so it had to have a beginning. The expansion of the universe and the Big Bang model both confirm this. Now, this tells us that the creation model in this area, the origin of the universe, is more plausible. Why? Because the universe, science has shown us that the universe had to have a beginning. And if the universe had to have a beginning, then that means something outside the universe had to cause it to exist. Since the universe had a beginning, something outside the universe had to cause it to exist. You see, the universe could not have evolved out of nothing. The universe could not have evolved out of nothing, because from nothing, nothing comes. Nothing is nothing, nothing does nothing, nothing causes nothing, therefore from nothing, nothing comes. So the universe had a beginning, something outside the universe had to cause it to exist. The universe could not have evolved out of nothing. Therefore, since the universe is not eternal, it had a beginning. The creation model is more plausible. Something outside the universe had to cause it to exist. Well, that's the origin of the universe. And the creation model we see is more plausible than the evolution model. But what about the origin of first life? The origin of first life. Well, evolution teaches spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation. Evolution teaches spontaneous generation, which teaches that life came from non-life without intelligent intervention. Evolution teaches spontaneous generation. Life came from non-life without intelligent intervention. But the creation model, on the other hand, whereas evolution teaches spontaneous generation, life came from non-life without intelligent intervention, the creation model teaches that an intelligent being intervened to bridge the gap from non-life to life. Creation model teaches that an intelligent being intervened to bridge the gap from non-life to life, formed Adam from the dust of the ground, but then breathed life into his nostrils. Now, the problem with the evolution model is that spontaneous generation violates the law of biogenesis and the cell theory. Spontaneous generation, just as it violated the first law, the second law of thermodynamics, it also violates the law of biogenesis and the cell theory. And remember, both laws and theories are higher in the evidence that they have backing it. They have much more evidence backing it than a model does. So spontaneous generation violates the law of biogenesis and the cell theory. The law of biogenesis teaches that all living things come from prior living things. Life comes from life. Evolution has to contradict that to get first life. The cell theory teaches that the cell is the smallest unit of life, yet all present cells came from prior cells. Well, yeah, first, your first cell, according to evolutionists, had to come from non-living matter. You see, natural laws by themselves do not produce specified complexity. Natural laws by themselves do not produce specified complexity. Well, what is specified complexity? Specified complexity is highly complex information. Highly complex information. Dr. Norman Geisler, great Christian philosopher of our day, has taught that natural laws can explain the Grand Canyon. Natural laws can explain the Grand Canyon, however, they cannot explain, natural laws cannot explain the faces on Mount Rushmore. Natural laws can explain the Grand Canyon, but they cannot explain the faces on Mount Rushmore. Why not? Because the faces on Mount Rushmore contain specified complexity, highly complex information. Only intelligence can bring that about, not natural laws. Well, what does this have to do with the origin of first life? Well, a single-celled animal, which is what first life is supposed to be, according to scientists, a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information. At one time they said to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. Now they say that a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill a library of information. A single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill a library. Now, the illustration's often been given, and it's a good one. Even if you had all the material necessary to make a dictionary, how many explosions would it take in a print shop to produce a Webster's dictionary? And the answer is, you can have an infinite number of explosions, you'll never get a Webster's dictionary, because intelligent intervention is needed to produce specified complexity. Intelligent intervention is needed to produce specified complexity. So in the origin of first life, the creation model is once again more plausible. Now Carl Sagan, who's an atheistic evolutionist, has said that a single message from outer space would prove intelligent life on other planets. Carl Sagan says a single message from outer space would prove intelligent life on other planets. Yet, he believes that a library worth of information got here by chance. Christianity is not a leap of blind faith. Atheistic evolution is, and Carl Sagan proves it by every time he inserts his foot into his scientific mouth. Dr. Wickramasinghe, one of Britain's leading scientists who was formerly an evolutionist, Dr. Wickramasinghe says that life could not possibly be produced by non-intelligence. And now he holds a belief that somehow intelligent intervention is needed to bring about life. But Dr. Wickramasinghe teaches that life couldn't be produced by non-life. So we see that the creation model is more plausible than the evolution model and the origin of the universe and the origin of first life. What about the origin of new complex life forms, new more complex life forms? Well, we could take a look at the fossil record. But in the fossil record, we don't find any evidence for evolution. You see, new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. You don't find half wings and half fins. How is a fish going to swim when he's got wings, or how is a bird going to fly when he's got fins? The fossil record, new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. There's gaps in the fossil record, no evidence for missing links. In fact, let's take a look at the human brain, which is supposed to, according to evolutionists, it's supposed to have evolved from a single-celled animal. What about the human brain? It contains enough information to fill 20 million volumes of encyclopedia. The human brain contains enough information to fill 20 million volumes of encyclopedia. Now, natural law cannot produce 20 million volumes of encyclopedia from one library of encyclopedia, which is what a single-celled animal is. Natural law cannot produce 20 million volumes of encyclopedia from one library, which is what a single-celled animal is. Again, intelligent intervention is needed to impart more complex information. See, evolution, now the evolutionists, they point to mutations, a garbling of the genetic code. Evolutionists point to mutations as the process by which evolution takes place. However, mutations do not add more complex information to the genetic code. Mutations only garble the genetic code. For instance, a single-celled animal has no genes for teeth. Where did humans get the genes for teeth if we came from single-celled animals? Now, even when you're a single-celled human being, an embryo at the moment, the zygote, at the moment of conception, you have genes already for your teeth and for what color hair you're going to have. Your whole blueprint is there. You don't find that in a single-celled animal. Evolutionists point to mutations as the process by which evolution takes place. However, mutations do not add more complex information to the genetic code. Mutations only garble the genetic code. You cannot, I repeat, you cannot go from the simple to the complex through natural law alone. Time plus chance plus natural laws never produces more complex information. And again, the creation model is more plausible. So what is the conclusion of our three scientific tests? What is the conclusion of our three scientific tests? Creationists have never seen the invisible creator. However, evolutionists have never seen the supposed evolutionary changes of the past. They'll say, hey, you Christians have blind faith in God. True, creationists have never seen the invisible creator, but evolutionists have never seen the supposed evolutionary changes of the past. The principles of uniformity and causality declare creationism to be far superior a model to that of evolution. The universe needs a cause, and since the universe is nature, the cause must be above nature, and therefore the universe needs a supernatural cause. And this cause must be an intelligent being to bring life from non-life and complex life forms from simple life forms. So the conclusion of our three scientific tests, the universe needs a supernatural cause, and this supernatural cause must be an intelligent being to bring life from non-life and complex life forms from simple life forms. And that proves that the creation model is much more scientifically plausible than the evolution model. Now, we only have about 10 minutes left. In the remaining time, I want to discuss very briefly. I'm going to run through them. You might just have to list the stuff and just listen. But I'm going to run through the major problems with evolution. First is energy conservation, the first law of thermodynamics. That says that the amount of energy in the universe is constant. It remains the same. No energy is now being created or destroyed. Therefore, whatever brought the universe into existence is no longer in operation today. Evolution is supposed to be an ongoing process. No new energy is coming into the universe. Whatever brought the universe into existence is no longer in operation today. Another problem with evolution, energy deterioration, the second law of thermodynamics. The amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. You see, the amount of energy remains constant, but while energy changes forms, it becomes less and less usable. So the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. Therefore, the universe will have an end. It had to have a beginning. And therefore, nature needs a supernatural cause. As we mentioned before, the Big Bang theory, or the Big Bang model, and the expansion of the universe also confirms the beginning of the universe. A third problem with evolution is the evolutionary dating methods. They are inconsistent and unreliable. They are based on the principle of uniformitarianism. Based on the principle of uniformitarianism, which assumes no worldwide catastrophes. They automatically assume that the worldwide flood is a fairy tale. They automatically assume that creation by God is a fairy tale. In short, they assume evolution is true, and then they date things based on that. Now, uniformitarianism assumes a constant rate of decay. So if they see two books, both with the same amount of dust on them, they assume, well, then they've both been there just as long. But one book could have been there twice as long, just that somebody might have walked in the room and dusted it off. So if there's divine intervention, such as a universal flood and creation by God, uniformitarianism falls and you won't have a constant rate of decay. Rocks known to be only a few hundred years old have been dated to be hundreds of millions of years old. Rocks known to be only a few hundred years old have been dated to be hundreds of millions of years old. Now, Dr. Henry Morris, the founder and president of the Institute for Creation Research in California, he is a scientist. He states that there's many different ways to date the Earth's age, but evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates. Many different ways to date the Earth's age, but evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates, since evolution needs millions of years even to seem slightly possible. In fact, there are some methods that point to a very young Earth, such as population statistics, moon dust, and the Earth's magnetic field. We don't have time to go any further in there. The fossil record, which is supposed to prove evolution, turns out to be a major problem for evolution. Fossil records assume to prove evolution, but shows absolutely no evidence of missing links. New life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. No half fins and half wings. No half arms and half wings, anything like that. The fossil record could point to a worldwide flood. Why? Because fossilization is extremely rare today. Even with the millions and millions of years that evolutionists want, you wouldn't have the fossilization that we have today. Yet, fossils are caused by rapid burial, which is exactly what a worldwide flood would do. In fact, in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 6 to 8, and Genesis 6 to 11 and 12, Psalm 104, verses 5 to 9, the canopy theory. The Bible teaches that God separated the waters above from the waters below by an expanse which he called the sky, the Earth's atmosphere. So there was approximately 40 days and 40 nights worth of water surrounding the Earth's atmosphere. And then when the flood came, those waters came from the sky, and hence you had the universal flood. Now, if the Earth were a smooth sphere, it would be covered with waters 2 miles deep everywhere. And so that just lets you know how much water there is on Earth. Now, I'm going to have to rush through this. We're really running low on time. You'll have to listen to it several times to get your notes on this. But the flood would tend to bury future fossils in this order. Creatures living in the deepest oceans would be on the bottom, then creatures in shallower waters, then amphibians and land-bordering creatures, then swamp, marsh, and low-river flat creatures, especially reptiles, higher mammals who retreated to higher ground with attempting to escape the flood would then be buried, and last, humans would be overtaken. Now, exceptions would be explained by upheavals in the Earth's crust after the flood. The worldwide flood model, that can explain the exceptions. Evolutionists cannot explain the exceptions, and there are many exceptions. By the way, a global ice age would follow the flood, yet evolutionists want the global ice age. They don't want the worldwide flood. A lack of vegetation would kill off the dinosaurs, and there's much evidence in the book of Job from Japanese fishermen. I have a photograph, an 8x11 photograph, of a dinosaur being freshly died, being pulled out of the water off the coast of New Zealand by Japanese fishermen. African natives have given reports of seeing dinosaurs, and we have legends as recent as the 1500s describing dinosaurs. Mutations offer another problem for evolution. They don't prove evolution because evolution needs new genes. Mutations only alter already existing genes. And the question comes up, where did single-celled animals get genes for teeth? There's also absolutely no evidence for missing links. I'm going to run through a few of these. Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man share the features of modern man. They're not missing links. Colorado man turned out to be a member of a horse family. Java man turned out to be a large gibbon. The Heidelberg man only consisted of a lower jaw. God knows what it was. The Piltdown man turned out to be a clever hoax. The Peking man turned out to be a large monkey or a baboon. The southern ape, Australopithecus, turned out to be an extinct ape, as did Ramapithecus. The East African man turned out to be an ape. Dryopithecus turned out to be an extinct ape. And then in 1925, at the evolution trial, the Nebraska man, a tooth, was presented as evidence for missing links between apes and men. However, 2 years later, the tooth was proven to be the tooth of an extinct pig. And then there's Archaeopteryx, thought to be the transitionary form between reptiles and birds, because it has teeth, lizard-like tail, and claws like a reptile, but it has wings and feathers like a bird. However, it's fully developed, it's not a missing link, and it is now classified as a bird. Now, because of these problems, there is punctuated equilibrium, started by people like Stephen Jay Gould, a scientist and evolutionist, because it's been 125 years since Darwin, and still we have no missing links. Therefore, punctuated equilibrium says, well, there's no missing links because there are none. In other words, the evolution happens so quick that you have two apes getting together and having a baby boy, and there'll be many baby boys and many baby girls born about the same time, and these mutations start the human race. So you won't find any missing links. Now, since evolution means gradual change, punctuated equilibrium talks about sudden changes. Has evolution been abandoned? Apparently so. Punctuated equilibrium attempts to explain away the lack of evidence for evolution. Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy is a theory in quantum physics which states that subatomic particle movement is presently unpredictable for man. But this does not mean things happen without a cause, like a lot of evolutionists try to claim. It simply means that scientists aren't yet able to accurately predict where a specific particle will be at a given time. Max Planck, a physicist, holds this view. Man is limited in knowledge because basically we can't state it. If you believe that things occur without a cause, then all of science crumbles. There's no sense in doing any kind of science at all. Another problem with evolution is many unproven assumptions. No evidence for spontaneous generation. Violates the cell theory and the law of biogenesis. Even Miller and Urey experiments, they attempt to bring life from non-life in the lab. If successful, they only show that intelligent intervention is needed. Dr. Norman Geisler has stated that the production of amino acids is as far from producing life as a single sentence is from one volume of an encyclopedia or even from a library of encyclopedias. Dr. Wickramasinghe calls these experiments cheating because you start with life, you break it down, and you get life in the end. Another unproven assumption of evolution is that the universe is not eternal. They need an eternal universe. Another unproven assumption would be the other side of that coin. The universe couldn't evolve from nothing. In fact, there's no proof for intelligence coming from non-intelligence, for multi-celled animals coming from single-celled animals. Remember, the embryo doesn't evolve into a human. It has the full genetic code at conception. There's no evidence for animals with backbones coming from animals without backbones, and no evidence for common ancestry between fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals, because common anatomy points more easily to common design than to common ancestry. Just some closing remarks. Evolution needs God, but God does not need evolution. If evolution is true, God is still needed to bring the universe into existence, life from non-life, and complex life forms from simple life forms in order to supersede the superseding of natural laws is needed. But if God exists, he doesn't need evolution. He could have started the long evolutionary process, or he could have created the universe in 6 days. God could have used evolution, but if he did, he left no evidence. Scientifically speaking, since the present interprets the past, the creation model is far superior to the evolutionary model. The creation model doesn't violate scientific laws. The creation model fits perfectly well with the data, while the evolution model fails miserably. Once Galileo was scoffed at by fellow scientists for thinking the Earth revolves around the Sun, and now creationists are being scoffed at for saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But as the decades pass, just as Galileo was vindicated, so too will creation science be vindicated, even though many evolutionists may never be able to abandon the blind faith they hold in the dead and unscientific religion called evolution. Thank you, and God bless you.